its anniversary. Okay, so this is July the...
Here we are at the Adam Sack Show. Thanks for tuning in.
July the 11th.
Who cares what date it is? Because we're here together with Adam Sack.
Oh, this is my parents' anniversary.
Oops. Did you call your mother?
I don't know. I think they're divorced.
They're divorced, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't think you... Do you celebrate divorce anniversary?
Your mother does.
I have to leave it to her.
Well, anyways, welcome everyone. Good to speak with you again. It's been a couple of weeks since you've heard from Adam, but he's back. And every week we're going to be discussing a topic of commonsensical life and law and application of life and law. And so you can hopefully pick up some tools in addition to the library of tools that Adam has been imparting upon you the last few years. And here we have a little less restrictive forum, and hopefully it'll be some topics of interest to you. You know his phone number, 818-253-6795.
We'll put the toll-free number, 800-340-7320. That's 1-800-340-7320.
And his email is adam@adamlawyer.com. Email him with any questions or topics you'd like to see him cover, and we'll go from there. Today we're going to talk about commonsensical application of your own good sense and smarts in dealing with problems, and in particularly lawsuits. Hopefully none of you have had the misfortune of being sued, but if you have, who do you call?
You gotta get yourself a lawyer. It's just too complicated to do it by yourself. A lot of people believe, kind of this lone wolf, Rambo, lone soldier. You're gonna go in there like in the movies, and the trumpets will be blaring, and you're gonna get justice. But it's not true. If you don't have an attorney, you go into court, you're basically naked, you're going to get screwed, is what's going to happen.
And don't you find for real that everyone thinks that the law works the way they see it on television?
And I think that, as much as I love her, I think Judge Judy has been very destructive in that respect, because people think that that's normal. They think that that's what a courtroom looks like. And we see in dramas, at the beginning of the show, the person comes in for a consultation, and by the end of the show, the case is a trial. And the reality is that cases go on for years. People know that. And most cases don't go to trial. The vast majority, more than 99% of cases, get settled. And so this thing where you're an attorney and you're doing a jury trial every week is just nonsense. It's just not true. It's not how it is at all. And people have false expectations that somehow, especially in family law, that they're going to be vindicated. Women think that sooner or later the judge is going to wag his finger at their husband and say, you're a bad man, and you were lying to your wife, and that there's going to be this this authoritative, one side vanquishes the other, and that's really not how it is at all.
Why do they think it's that way? Where do they get that?
People think that somehow the courts and the judges are going to take the place of, their parents, I think. Or like when you were in school, and a kid pushed you, and you went to the teacher or the principal, and the principal gave the kid detention, for hurting you. But somehow this is the adult version. And the analogy that I can think of is when people call the police. People think that because they're the ones that phone the police, that when the police come, that the police will be on their side. And, the police sort of pull in with their cars, and you say, officer, he pushed me, he stole my thing, he did whatever. And the cops immediately are going to, deck him and put the cuffs on and, rough him up a little and, take his ass to jail. But in reality, the police don't see their job that way at all. They see their job as very neutral in keeping the peace. And just because you call the police because your wife punched you, you're just as likely to get arrested as her. And in fact, if you're the man, more likely. So the idea that these neutral arbiters are coming to, dispense justice is absolutely false. And the courts don't work that way at all.
So the reality is this. The reality is that everyone, for the most part, who has been fortunate enough not to have to experience a legal problem, having to retain a lawyer or go to court or been sued or a traffic ticket, have no idea what the world of law and how it functions for a fact. Just like we don't know how a doctor does a surgery. You go in, a doctor says, okay, we got to take this out. You go, okay. You go in, they give you anesthesia, you wake up, okay, it's all gone, we fixed you.
It must have happened.
It must have happened. You don't ask what's got to be done.
That's like they say, like how sausage made, you know?
Yeah.
If you saw what was put in it and how it was made, you wouldn't eat it.
Exactly.
Because it's gross, you know?
So just like medicine is unique and dentistry is unique, you have to go see a legal doctor because law has its own set of rules and functions, and it's not what you see on TV, not even close. There's no love, there's no heart, there's no emotion, which is one of our keys today as far as emotion in approaching a problem. You know, you have to use your own intelligence in everyday life. You don't cross the street on a red light, you don't drive through red lights. You know what's right, you know what's wrong. You have a good sense of what to do every day. And you have to do the same thing when a relationship is broken. You have to get past the emotionality and use your smarts, because that smarts now is going to kick into a legal arena where you now have to learn this new world we just talked about that's not like television.
Well, I also think it's a grand reconfiguration, because especially when you're a man and you're married, your inclination very naturally is to be protective of your spouse, of your wife. And, you know, this is something that you're taught as a young man. Women are frail, you know, they're smaller than guys usually. And, you know, there's this whole idea as the protector and the defender and all that sort of thing. And then one day, almost at the flip of a switch, this person becomes your enemy. And she's trying to think of the things that you've done and use them against you. She's gathered information and documents and bank statements to try to use against you. And a lot of guys have a big problem in making that kind of mental reconfiguration. And they start saying to me, yeah, but you can't do that to her. That's going to upset her. You can't do that. That's going to make her feel bad. And the answer is, well, yeah, of course it's going to make her feel bad. She's not your friend anymore. And that's a big change for people. That's very, very difficult to recognize.
Totally.
And on some other level, you know, if you have kids especially, you're still going to have to deal with this person. So you're going to have a relationship of some kind that's going to be tense, and you're going to have to find a way, literally, with a court's call, to co-parent. But at the same time, you're going into court, and here's someone who's sticking it to you, who's saying terrible things about you. When you read the paperwork, a lot of people are shocked, where the wife is saying that you're a drug addict, or an alcoholic, or you're out of control, or you need to take anger management classes because you're such a vicious, angry person that you can't control your rages. And she's going to talk about the incident that happened at the Christmas party 2 years ago, how you threw something at somebody or whatever. And you know, she's sort of undermining this thing where at one time she was trying to, you know, say you were a good father and build you up, and now she's trying to do just the opposite and tear you down.
And it also goes the other way around. It's what you're saying that the other person has done to gather up papers and things like that. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. And whether you're the guy or the girl or whatever, you know when the relationship is over, like for real. And you know how long it's been bad, and you know how long you've been unhappy. And the trick is, you now have to make that transition and identify what you need to do to protect yourself, protect your children, and get ready for that split. And when you come to that realization that it's done and it's over, well, you've got to then get to the next step. And the next step is getting tools. And what is the tools that you need? You need to have focus. You need to have total focus. And total focus is a game plan. And what is that game plan? Well, part of it's an exit. How are you going to get out? Whether you're the guy or the girl, whatever spouse you are, even if just a plain relationship where you're living together, you got to have a game plan. When are you getting out? You don't have to share that with anybody, but you have to figure it out yourself. And if you have children, it's more complicated because getting out sometimes means kicking out the other spouse if things aren't right.
They don't necessarily want to leave.
Exactly. And if there's no violence, hopefully, then you can get stuck living with that person under the same roof because your circumstances don't allow you to go get separate residences. So if you figure out your game plan, the breakup plan, you know, maybe and hopefully you have a couple dollars saved because you always need money. So if you don't have it, go see a relative, go see a friend, because you need that exit plan as part of your exit plan for a new place, maybe, and probably for a lawyer.
Right. The other thing that a lot of lawyers, I find, don't help people with, and something that I think is critical, is a strategy, which is a plan, which is sort of sitting down and saying at the outset, you know, what's important, what are the goals here, and if I look back at this time, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now, where do I want to be? So, for example, when you're talking about a divorce, do you want the house, or do you want to sell the house, or do you want custody, or do you want to share custody, or do you want to move to another state, or what's your expectation, and where do you need to be? Because if you don't make an overall strategy, basically you're adrift. And the other thing is that events have a life of their own. I'll give you a good example. When you talk about your strategy and plan for moving out, for making the actual split, a lot of people hesitate for a very long time. And the problem is that you also have a partner in this. And if you're thinking about it and trying to decide what to do, meanwhile, your ex may go to court first, or may get a restraining order against you and get you kicked out of the house, or may take steps that are very adversarial to your interests. And while you're sitting there, you know, being Hamlet and contemplating, you know, what should I do, the other person may be on the move and may get a real legal and strategic advantage over you because of your hesitation. And that thing, you know, if you snooze, you lose, that's really true.
That's key. The key to all of this, which is part of your game plan, is you need to go see someone, you need to figure out what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, because as Adam said earlier, your other half is no longer your friend. And if you think they're going to hurt you financially and try to take money from you or hide some money from you or assets or whatever, while you're sitting around and not doing anything, they're busy. So as part of your game plan, you got to go line yourself up an attorney. Because you have to be clear that you do not bring a knife to a gunfight.
Right.
And in a legal situation, whether it's divorce, whether it's a custody fight, whether it's a civil case where someone's suing you for money for a breach of contract or a car wreck, the guys with the lawyers are the gunslingers. And the people who are not have the knives in their hands, and they're not going to have the knowledge that you need to know to do all of this.
The one thing I always hear is the guy say to me, I can't believe she did this. So, I mean, your girl too, man. People always say, no, my wife, you know, she's gentle, she's not like that, she would know. Yes, she would. And when the friendship's gone and the love is gone, the only thing that's left is money. And she is going to be looking out for her interests.
We were in court the other day on a case where the wife had married after living with our guy for over 10 years and raising a kid for over 10 years. And during those 10 years, she had two affairs.
Right.
And they both played pretend that they really cared for each other because of the child when they really didn't like each other. And that's that. It's when you got a funny thing going on like that, things are funny to begin with, and things funny in the middle of the relationship and funny in the end.
Right.
You know? So you don't wait. Be truthful to yourself. You know, oh, hang in 5 more years. Well, 5 more years, you could be a million different places or directions, career or otherwise. So you don't want to wait. Lawyers are free to go talk to. You don't wait to see a dentist. You don't wait to see your doctor. You don't wait to see your psychiatrist. Don't wait to see a legal doctor.
It's very common that people come to us and sit down with me, and it's such a crisis. So in other words, it's like the dentist you just said. Are you going for your regular checkups? Are you getting your teeth cleaned?
No.
Or?
No.
You already know the answer. Are you going to the dentist only when you're in agony and you have a crisis situation in your mouth, you know?
Crisis only.
Well, when you're finally spitting up blood and you say, okay, now I have to go to the dentist, you're in a much more critical situation. When people call me and they tell me, oh my God, I've just been served with a restraining order and the police arrested me, and you know, it's like this whole cascade of events. I say, you know, where were you 2 months ago? We would have been in a much stronger position. It's going to be much more difficult to deal with all this now. And they say, yeah, you know, I knew my marriage was a disaster. I knew we were going to get a divorce. I knew it was screwed up for a long time, for years. And people just can't face it. They just tread water, you know?
And when people do that, you place yourself in what we call a pretend world. And you write a scenario that doesn't exist that makes you comfortable. And the sugar coating does not take away the reality. We had a fellow call us, and he's married now, and he's got a couple kids. And now he has a baby mama who's knocking at the door. And he has sold that on his new wife, and they call it an indiscretion. I had an indiscretion.
Yeah, a little indiscretion.
So they call us up, and they're talking about this little indiscretion. And we go, wait a minute, you cheated on your wife, right? You were married at the time? Yeah. So you had this baby while you were married to this wife? We go, it was an indiscretion. Okay, well, that's kind of pretend, and I'm glad they worked it out. I mean, that's the best part, the present marriage stays together, they've worked it out. But you're talking in pretend land, and that's the point of our story tonight. Deal with reality. Not with pretend. And if a guy is smacking you around, then get out, lady. Call the cops or get him kicked out. You don't have to be a doormat for anybody. If someone's talking to you mean and treating you mean day after day, you don't have to take that. Get out. Remember the last time you were really happy? Like really, really happy, whatever that was in your life? When maybe you were in high school. And it was,
when you were 12.
When you were 12 and you got your pony or your dog or whatever. Or
you say, or I haven't been really happy for a long time.
Exactly. Or you had that one person in your life who just really just lit you up. You can have that again. Not necessarily, it doesn't have to be involved with someone. Even if you're alone and someone's not yelling at you every day, telling you what's wrong with you, all that terrible stuff because they're mad at themselves, you don't need to do that. Go out and be happy. Get liberated. Go get a lawyer. Get out and turn your life around. Because life is short, you know, and you need to know what the laws are. And it's simple. Lawyers are on every corner. They're in the yellow pages. They're all over the internet. They're like McDonald's. But hopefully you'll call Adam Sachs first at 818. No, that 800 number. What's that 800 number?
800-340-7320. 800-340-7320. 7320.
I never call you on that number.
It's going to be a waste of money.
Okay. Call you on the other number, you still don't answer me.
All right, that's a different issue.
So, the point is, come to the realization of whatever the deal's going on. Execute with your intelligence. Because sadness isn't going to solve the problem. You've got things to do. You need to take care of yourself. You need to take care of your children. And the best part is, you now become your own boss. You now become the driver of the bus. No one's telling you what to do. You don't want to pick up after yourself when you get home. You don't have to do it. You don't want to do your laundry. You don't have to do it. You don't want to do the dishes. You don't have to do it. If that's what you want to do. But the best part is, you get yourself back to the present and you learn your self-sense once again. Love and emotion has nothing in law. Love and emotion comes in with custody, kind of, as far as good sense. But the cold hard facts, as far as a lawsuit, when someone sues you, you have to answer the lawsuit, you have to respond, you have to do something affirmative. So use your sense and use the law to help you, because then you know what the arena is. Right?
Right. What ends up happening too often is that people underestimate the fight. They try to avoid the fight. They try to minimize it. I've seen a lot of terribly abused women that were with really, really brutes, men that were beating them up, doing cruel things to them. And the woman is saying, well, you know, it's only sometimes, and he doesn't mean it, and he doesn't mean to hurt me, and he was just kidding. And it's a terrible reality to be able to sort of recognize the death of the dream. When you had these little dolls that you played with when you were a child, and you dreamed of your wedding, and you dreamed of your husband, and you dreamed of your marriage, and to be able to be an adult as a mature person and look at that and say, I've done it and it's not working and I can't do it anymore, is a very, very difficult step to take. And the problem is that a lot of times, as I've said, while people are ignoring it and being in denial, the situation gets worse and worse. And it ends up being something that could have been handled much more easily and much more straightforward. And it ends up being a much, much bigger mess later on for someone like me as your attorney to fix, because things have been left to fester.
Some things can be fixed with one court appearance.
That's right.
Some problems can't be fixed until you do several court appearances, like 4, 5, 6, 7. And some problems, big problems, particularly if the judge isn't getting it the first time, take several months of accumulating evidence to present to the court before the court will believe your side. Because now you have the evidence to show the court what you're talking about. That you were talking 9 months ago and they thought you were crazy. Oh, you were really right after all.
It just took a while for the judge to realize.
You know, and the problem with that stuff, it's so expensive to get the judge to turn around, but you have to do it. You don't have a choice. Otherwise, you'll lose whatever your argument that you're trying to present at the time. You know, so you've used your smarts, you've gone to a lawyer. Now you know what's really going on. You're either the plaintiff, or if in family law you're the petitioner, same thing. Or you're the defendant, or in family law you're the respondent, same thing. Complaint is civil. In family law we call it a petition. An answer in civil, we call it a response in family law. So now you know what's going on. You're sued, or you're being sued, or you want to sue somebody, so, or you want to file for divorce. So go out and talk to as many lawyers as possible, because Each one will have a little bit of a take that's different from somebody else. And you just might find somebody, such as Adam, who has a completely different cut-to-the-chase, bottom-line approach that saves you money, but it'll tell you the predictors of what to expect. Because you just don't file a lawsuit and it takes care of itself. There's things that have to happen.
Now, when you think about this starting part, even some of the very minor things, and they sometimes sound kind of silly, but they actually end up being very, very important. So, for example, Sergio, what's your name? Mr. Valenti was saying that you could be the respondent or you could be the petitioner. But the truth is, it's very important to be the one that files first, because you get to choose the courthouse and you get to have more of the power and the circumstances of setting up the background and the first hearings and basically being the person driving the bus.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Well, that's really significant.
What that means is that when you decide to file a lawsuit, you should decide what courthouse you want to file it in. Because some courthouses only have a couple judges or one judge that does civil law or one or two judges that do family law. And by reputation, if you have some bad judges at the small courthouse, you definitely don't want to file there. You want to file at a different courthouse if it's possible. Usually the county seat, you can file anything. And that's where you want to go, because they'll have 10 or 12 judges in every area of law, except for probate. Probate, I think they have like only downtown LA, that is.
Well, it also depends on the size of the county that you're in.
Right. So you may be stuck with one or two different judges as your only option. You need to know what's going on with that, because that's part of your game plan and learning the process. Okay, you need to go sue this guy. He didn't pay you for painting his house. Okay, great. Where are we going to sue him? Well, we should do it on the local courthouse here, because I know the judge. Oh, he's a member of my country club, and we say hello all the time. Not that it's going to mean anything to your case, but the fact he sees a familiar face such as myself all the time makes things a little easier. That's part of the game plan. That's part of placing your case where you'll get some good attention, or you know the judge is more fair than another judge.
That's also crude, but it's like this thing I said about being in the driver's seat. I mean, that's really a factor. The person who has the initiative always wins. It's really a big deal for you to be the one that's choosing where the case is placed and what's emphasized on the case and what the first hearings are going to be about. Are we starting off with a restraining order? Or are we starting off with custody issues being resolved, the financial issues being resolved? You want to be the one who sets that background. You don't want to have it done to you, and then you're always playing defense rather than offense. And that's why, if you look at statistics, more than 85% of cases are filed by women. It's really interesting. Men put it off and wait and are hopeful and somehow it's going to work out. Women break up and they say, that's it, I've had enough, not another minute, and they file. And they, by taking that initiative, and they already have a huge advantage in family law anyway, this gives them an even bigger advantage.
If you live, let's say, in town A, and now you break up with your spouse, and that spouse now lives in town B, which is 45 miles away and an hour by car. And the way she did that, or he did that, was they ran to court and they got a court order getting permission to do that while you sat around thinking about doing it. They ran to court, they got a court order, they did something affirmative to protect themselves, take care of business for themselves, and or the children, or possession of the car, whatever, to make their life easier away from you, they have now done it while you are still thinking about doing it. So you don't wait. You come to the decision and you get going. You have no choice if there's kids involved. You have no choice if there's money being taken and hidden. You've got to do something, so use your intelligence. Go lawyer shopping and get a lawyer. You'll find someone someplace you can afford, because now you're fighting the war.
Well, think about what you just said, the emergency aspect. Think about bank accounts that are mutual. While you're thinking it over, this person could be draining the accounts, right?
I went to use the ATM the other day, and there was no money in it.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, I had $3,000 in it from my direct deposit the other day, and now it's all gone.
Ah. Also, people can do the opposite. They can run up credit cards. If you have joint credit cards, you know, your wife wants to be a nasty person, she can go shopping and
spend a lot
of money.
Well, we've been living apart now for 2 months now. Well, how does she get money? I don't give her anything.
Oh, she's got your credit card, maybe.
Yeah, I got this bill for $15,000 the other day.
Oh, dear.
How much? I had $30,000 credit. You know, what should I do?
Well, it's a problem, obviously. But you let it happen. That's what I'm trying to say.
I don't have $15,000 to pay that down.
Yeah, well, that's going to be an even bigger problem for you then, right?
It's going to happen.
Well, you're going to default on it. You're not going to pay it. You're going to have to pay it. You're going to have to get her to pay it. Maybe she doesn't have the money.
But I didn't make the charges.
I understand, but marriage is partnership. So when you're married to someone, if they start doing crazy stuff or spending money, that's your partner. You're responsible for their acts and you're responsible for their spending.
Yeah, but she went to Las Vegas for a week on my card.
I know.
She stayed at the Wynn.
Well, she's got good taste.
Wynn should give us free rooms now.
She's got expensive taste.
Yeah. She never did that before.
Yeah, well, that's that other conversation that I have all the time, is the guys who tell me, oh, no, not my wife. She's not like that.
You know, that's part of the realization. Once you make that step to file whatever it is, whatever kind of lawsuit it is, the person who you're suing or who you're being sued from, you've already realized they're not your friend.
That's for sure.
But what you will now experience is what we always talk about, is a deprogramization of the other side. Let's say it's your spouse, because that's the easiest example to take. You know, you've been married X amount, or you've lived with someone X amount of years, and you've got kids maybe, or maybe you don't. And the relationship, as all relationships, change over a period of time.
Right.
And let's say you're now in a relationship that's been pretty sour for quite some time, and there usually is a dominant figure in the two of you, whether it's the man or the woman. And someone is always calling the shots, for the most part, and telling you what to do and how to do it and what's wrong with you and what you should be doing.
What you're doing wrong.
And when in reality, the person who with all this stuff spewing out is the person who needs the work to be done.
Right.
Not the one they're picking on.
Very often the case. Very often the case.
So what happens is, when you finally wake up and you go, guess what? I am getting a lawyer. I'm going to sue you because you won't fix my car, or you fixed it wrong, or you're mistreating me, or whatever. That person now has to go through a deprogramming period, because they're not used to ever being told what to do by you, or being stood up by you, or by anyone. You know, someone could push you around, and you find out when you sue them, all of a sudden, they have a whole different personality.
Well, that's a classic thing that Norman Mailer said, the writer. They said to him, why were you married so many times? And he says, well, you never really know a woman until you divorce her.
Yeah.
And that's the reality.
Yeah.
You get to see a whole different side of a person.
So when someone comes to us for protection, let's say a restraining order, we always go through what we're talking about right now as part of the process. And that is, the other person's going to have to get used to that they don't get to kick you around anymore.
Right.
That no matter how much they yell at you, or insult you, when that used to affect you, now because you don't care, it doesn't affect you anymore. And when they see it doesn't compute with them, because they're used to scaring you or intimidating you, and you always reacted a certain way for so very long, and now that you don't have to put up with that anymore, and you truly, really don't care, they then learn there's a set of rules that you have to follow. You can't beat them up anymore, you can't push them around anymore. When they try to do that, you go to court, Adam gets you a court order that says if you do this, the cops are going to come get you, or you're going to be arrested, or you're in contempt.
Right. That changes the whole circumstance. And there's dynamics in the relationship are going to be the same dynamics in the divorce. And what Mr. Valente is talking about, essentially, was, let's say, the husband that was kind of a bully, where he would get into some kind of a disagreement with the wife and argue, and then he would, like, threaten her, he would get, you know, physical, or maybe not physical, but the threat of force, and he would say things to her like, yeah, I'm going to break your neck and you'll be sorry. And that was something that he was used to being able to wield over her.
You're nothing without me.
Well, even those kind of insulting
things. This is my house. I pay the bills.
A lot of women will say things like that too, you know. You're so lucky, you're never going to get another woman or whatever. You know, I'm much too attractive. You know, you're never going to be able to be with such a hot woman like me or whatever. And the thing is that those things become useless later on. And the person was used to kind of doing that. I've seen a lot of husbands in court that were used to pushing the wife around. And for the first time, I'm defending her. And they can't even believe it. And they're like, nah, I mean, you're going to do what I tell you. And the wife just looks at them and she's like, blank. I'm not doing what you tell me. Forget it. The guy's been doing it for so long, he's used to it working.
We get the husbands that show up and stare.
Yeah.
Like that, like laser beams.
Yeah.
They stare at their spouse from 50 feet away. Because like that's used to work.
Yeah, they give her the scary stare.
We had this ninja warrior guy who's a big karate guy. And he just kept staring at us like, oh my God, it looks good kill. Like,
I'm going to show her.
You know, we go in court, Adam gets the orders, he walks out penniless, and he's like, oh, keep you staring. That really helped you there. Really helped you out a whole bunch, you know. And it's crazy, but they get deprogrammed, and the way they get deprogrammed is they bother you, and you get... You go to court and you get an order that says you don't get to bother me no more.
Right.
And it's the first time you have stood up to that person or people or persons.
Well, that's an education process too.
It's a learning process. It's the real process of the law. If someone is hurting you, that's the only time you'll see sympathy or emotion from a judge. They'll see that that's going on. But the law says if someone's hurting you or bothering you, that there's law that says that they can stop that. So whether it's like the naked picture stuff or nasty phone calls or texting, cyber texting, we'll get into that one day. That's a whole deal. Cyber texting.
We've also seen this thing you're talking about where they you take intimate pictures and you put them on the internet. That's happened this week with Rob Kardashian. And that's now actually a crime. And that, in his case, led to a restraining order.
And if there's somebody somewhere in the district attorney's office that doesn't like him or the family, they will get the green light to prosecute him.
Right.
And because he's not a criminal and a bad guy, and it's his first offense, he'll, you know, get community service or a warning or probation or whatever, but they'll put him through the process. Because getting celebrities now for wrongdoings is sexy, rather than in the old days where they would walk away for doing the most horrendous things. Now they want to get them and make them examples.
Guys always tell me that there's no way my wife is going to press charges against me. But what's actually happened is that the law has changed that women cannot drop the charges. That's the joke. What used to happen is that the man would be arrested, the wife would come out the next day and bail him out, and you know, they'd sleep it off and she dropped the charges. And so they changed the laws that once these things happen, these incidents are reported, when the police arrest usually the man, the woman cannot drop the charges. The district attorney will do the case against the husband without her testimony if she's not cooperative. And it doesn't matter because they have the testimony of the police, other witnesses, and they also have physical evidence. So the fact that you call the police and started the case, that's what counts. And so later on, sometimes people think, well, we can smooth this over, or we went to marital therapy or whatever, and it's too late. And like Mr. Villani said, when you look at the case of the district attorney, their decision to prosecute is made internally by their own processes, and you cannot influence that. And I have seen people in court where the other spouse is yelling at the district attorney and saying, I don't want this case, I don't want to prosecute, I want you to drop it. And they just look at him and go, no, we're not doing that, I'm sorry. I'm doing this, this is for the people of the state, it's for your own good. You're too dumb to know what that means. But your husband's been abusing you, and I'm not going to tolerate it, even if you're willing to. And that also, obviously, those criminal cases have a big impact later. If you have a restraining order, or if you have a criminal case or criminal conviction, that's going to have a big influence on the family law judge and how they decide custody. When they're looking at custody, and you're the man, let's say, and you want joint custody, you want to have shared parenting, and the judge sees that you've been convicted of domestic violence against your spouse, and maybe you did it in front of the kids, or the kids were also covered by the protective orders because they were at least present or in the house or whatever, you know, the judge is not going to give you joint custody, and that's going to have a big impact. And not only that, it's going to impact the way the judge looks at you in general. When your case gets called and the judge has your file in front of them, they're looking at it and they're going, oh, here's this piece of crap guy that beat up his wife. You know, oh, and what does he want? He wants custody? Give me a break. I'm not giving him custody.
Well, I said I'm sorry. I told her. She's not mad at me anymore.
It's all, fixed.
You know, she's not mad at me anymore, right, honey?
Well, a lot of this is also influenced by what they call feminist theory, where, you know, men are natural abusers and women are natural victims. And this is something that has a big impact in our world today. And a lot of the judges, don't forget, get training for judges. They go and learn, you know, theories and domestic violence, and they take courses under the modern theories. And a lot of these theories believe, and I think it's absolutely wrong, but it's typically accepted today that, you know, in the domestic violence situation, that we live in a patriarchal society and that men are in control of most of the money and most of the power in our society. And so a man exercises his authority wrongfully over his spouse by threatening her or beating her up. And, you know, one of the things that guys get convicted of, which they can't even believe, is terrorist threats. A lot of guys call me and they say, I cannot believe it. I've been charged with making terrorist threats, which you would think is some kind of, you know, some kind of terrorism or something, but it's not.
Blow up your car.
Yeah, if you're, and you may not have said it, but if your spouse alleges that you said, I'm going to blow up your car, I'm going to burn down the house, you know, I'm going to get even with you. That's a terrorist threat.
You'll be sorry. Cars burn real easy.
You'll be sorry is a big one.
Sugar in gas tanks just kind of happened by accident.
Yeah, well, sugar in the gas tank is destroying the car. That's a whole different story.
Also, people don't understand is that once they make a complaint, let's say a criminal complaint,
right?
The county is out of money. The county has spent money.
That's right.
The county is spent for a private investigator or a county employee.
They're invested.
To interview you. Excuse me.
Bless you.
This is live. And interview you and interview the neighbors. And someone's being paid per hour to go out on the streets or sit on the phone and talk to people and generate a report and give that report to a superior who goes to a superior, goes to whatever, who interfaces with whomever else. And the county is now out of pocket. Just like when you want to get a ticket, part of maybe one of the tactics in negotiating a ticket is paying the fine and being able to walk or whatever. We'll get that on another show. But the key is money. The county wants their money. And if they've spent money, they're not going to dismiss a case because you decided you love whomever has abused you and you have now forgiven them for the umpteenth time. It doesn't work that way.
So, I also think it's very agenda-driven. I deal with a lot of prosecutors,
yeah,
and I think a lot of them are feminists, and they have a real theoretical attachment, or they're a young woman who got into this because their father abused their mother, or they have other experiences of trauma in their own lives, in their own childhoods. And so you're dealing with someone not only that put time into it and doesn't want to walk away from that investment on behalf of the county, the people, but they actually have a personal investment in it. And I've dealt with prosecutors that were really upset. They were like really like self-righteous with like an attitude. And they say to me, how dare you? And your client is a piece of crap. And look what he did to her. And I'm like, do you know these people? Why are you so upset? Why are you so invested in it? And you see that it's something that's much deeper than what you would think. And the problem with that kind of, you know, thinking is, you're not dealing with a person that really wants to negotiate. You're not dealing with a rational person. You're dealing with a person who's personally offended by what happened. And that just makes everything 10 times more complicated.
Well, let's talk about that setup. Okay, it's criminal. We're in the criminal courtroom now.
Criminal is a whole different story.
This is how criminal law works in the real world. It's not that funny sound you hear on TV and the big fat judge looking over his nose and the sexy DA. Here's how it works. The district attorney's office is a corporation. Look at it as a company, okay? And you have a president, and you have a vice president and assistant vice presidents, and then you have district managers. Then you have assistant district managers, then you have branch managers and assistant branch managers. The district attorney's office is the same way. You got the head of the DA, and then that person's got an assistant and a couple assistants, and each one trickles down to the city and the courts and the courtrooms, and everybody's got to report to a boss. And their job is to prosecute,
right,
put you in jail. Guilty, get you fined. That's their job. Their job is whether the circumstances are that you are innocent, they have one job. Prosecute every case. And they've got quotas, just like policemen have quotas. Policemen don't say they have quotas, but if they know on the corner of Elm and Peachtree that there's a stop sign and in the last 2 years 500 people have gone through it, and you're the new policeman on patrol, and you only have 50 tickets for this year, something's wrong. Well, prosecutors are supposed to prosecute. And if you want to get a raise or a promotion in the district attorney's office and go from grade C to B- or whatever they do with their classifications, you've got to get prosecutions. You've got to put people in jail. You could be a first-timer, and like Adam said, something about you, that person doesn't like you, well, they're going to be getting brownie points for putting you in jail and finding you guilty on something that's worthless. And that's how that works. Now, if someone's been in criminal court a bunch, like Mr. Sachs, and he sees the DA a lot, and they know, oh, hey, Adam, how you doing? Yeah, I haven't seen you for a year. All of a sudden, that friendliness and nonchalantness kicks in and makes them more approachable and maybe willingness to cut a deal, whereas somebody who you're meeting for the first time, who is like really proud right out of law school and this is their first job and they're to show that they're a tough guy, they're not going to cut you a deal. And then they're going to make you go through the whole process versus Adam, who knows Joe Schmo because he's talking about the Dodger game or whatever. Those things matter. You're not going to break the law. You're not going to skirt around the law. You're going to have somebody in that corporate environment to deal with you on a more congenial manner. Right, Adam?
Absolutely. It's surprising how little things matter sometimes. And as I said, the most frightening thing that you can get in the world is a true believer. And that's what I was talking about. Someone who's new at the job, for example. Or someone, like I said, who has some kind of emotional investment, or their mother beat up the father or something. These are people that don't want to be rational, because somehow they feel that they're, you know, fixing something that happened in their childhood or something. And I find those people terrifying, because then you're not talking to someone who's willing to work things out. You're talking to someone who's very, very, very emotionally invested. And when you're emotionally invested, your brain turns off. I mean, I've sat down many times where I say to the prosecutor, is this so important, this shitty little case? And for them, it's like, well, yeah, you know, look what he did. And that's a big danger. And you have to recognize that. You know, when you look at the courts, and this is also something going back to what we were talking about when we first started this segment, you know, the judge has dozens of cases. People just don't understand that. You know, this idea that the judge is sitting there thinking about your case and, you know, he's in an easy chair and he's got a pipe and he's sort of, you know, contemplating the case and contemplating the universe for you. It's not true. Your average court in the morning has an agenda probably with maybe 30, 35, 40 cases.
In 3 hours.
Yeah, and the judge has to get through them. And to not do them all and to have them carry over to the next day for a judge is a real pain in the ass, because then the next day is going to be even more, you know, crowded with cases from the leftovers. And they don't want to have to bring people back, and people don't want to come back, or they've got conflicts or whatever. So the judge wants to get through their calendar. And so your case is like, you know, people think they're going to get this big analysis. It's very important to you, of course, but the judge may give you, well, you know, 30 seconds, maybe a minute and a half, and that's about it. And I'm always surprised when I come into court, and this has happened many, many times, where the judge just says, you know, I haven't read your papers. Let's go.
And let's talk about the judge's life.
What did I write them for?
What's the judge's life? Everybody thinks the judge sits there, okay, off with his head, yes. 20 years. The way it works is, let's say it's family law, for instance, and you're going to court for spousal support. The judge has about 350 cases that he has assigned to him. Now, he's got a boss also.
Yes, right.
That judge who's working your case has a boss.
Supervising judge.
And that boss is looking to see how many cases that they're concluding, getting through, going to trial, disposing of, forcing settlement, because all that means something. They don't want the cases to go to trial. They want them to settle, or they want you to force you to settle, because it takes up a lot of room and a lot of time, because everybody is filing lawsuits. So he's got to read every single one of those 350 cases.
Right.
Every single one. And if he's lucky or she's lucky, they'll have a clerk that will do the reading. Now that means they got somebody telling the judge what to do. The judge hasn't read the case, doesn't want to read the case because he'd rather be out on the golf course on the weekends. Or he'd rather be home, or she at home, right at 5 o'clock at the end of the day, because now they got someone to do it for them. And you'll have, and the person reading that is in law school, not a lawyer. But in some cases they have lawyers that do that for the judges. They're called research lawyers. You got a law school student telling the judge to throw you away for 20 years. And then what happens is they sit down and there's the file. They open the file and there's their clerk, Johnny, from Pepperdine, and he writes a nice little story in the law that backs it up, and then the bottom line says, give him 20 years. And the judge goes, okay, 20 years. And the judge really knows nothing,
right?
Like for real, nothing about the case.
So the clerk said.
But the clerk said. I walked in once and go, how did the judge have the decision on that? And the clerk, since knew me by familiarity, pulled the file, open it up, and on a yellow sticker was the words, not guilty.
Throw the book at him.
Not guilty.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, where's the notes? The clerk says,
that's the notes.
This is it. And that day we had briefs of, like, you know, 2 inches thick, 20 exhibits. You spent your weekend writing it. That kind of thing.
Right.
But that's what the judges do and have to go through. And then you have the judges that actually read every case and work on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the dedicated ones, far and few, but there's a few. Mm-hmm. So that's their life. Now they got 3 hours to get through 20, 30 cases, and they don't have a lot of particular interest. And sometimes, more often than not, they'll forget about a case. We got a case the judge has had us in front of her 30 times. She knows everything about the case. And when we were in there the other day, she knew nothing about the case.
She's got hundreds of cases.
Nothing.
I thought she was really into it. She knew it. She knew us. Nah. She was like, I don't have the file. I don't know what's going on.
She forgot she hated you.
Yeah.
That's what gave it away.
She was mad at me and she forgot.
How come she's nice to you today? She doesn't remember anything about this case.
Maybe I should be happy about that, I suppose.
Gosh, she was so nasty the last time.
I guess I should be glad that her nasty attitude had diminished.
So, back to what we were doing before, and that was game plan, going to court, knowing what's going on for sure, like for real, not with like on TV. And just because your girlfriend got $1 million, you don't know really what went on in her case. Or the painter who painted that house just like the one you painted and got paid more. They're all different. And it all comes down to when it's all happening in front of the judge. And in the case of family law, you're now calling the shots. You're now driving the bus. You're telling the other person what's going on. You're not getting pushed around anymore. And the best part is you're getting a hold of your life and a new direction for your life. And if it's a civil situation, you're doing the same thing. You're not going to get cheated out of the money that someone owes you. You're not going to get cheated out of services that someone owes you. Or if you've done something wrong, go find out how to fix it. Maybe it's just writing a check for a few $100. Maybe it's trading services to satisfy the problem.
Well, that's the creative solutions, and that's true also at family law. You know, sometimes there's a lot of hurt feelings stuff, but as Mr. Villani said, you know, sometimes you write a check for a few $100, or you fix something, or you trade something, or you let the woman have her mother's china, and that's really what they were fighting about. And a lot of times when you have marriages and circumstances that are strange, like infidelity, or people cheating and lying and stuff like that, that ends up changing the circumstances where people are more angry and they're going to be less inclined to be rational, where they're being offered large amounts of money and selling the house and having half the money, and they say no, 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 because what they want is literally some kind of vindication, or they want an apology. They want their husband to say he's sorry, or not even him. Sometimes it's even an external person. Let's say he had an affair with one of the mutual friends or something, they want the friend to say she's sorry. So, you know, you have to kind of look at that in these circumstances. And the courts, as I said, you know, they make decisions that are very important, but it's really the role of the attorneys to be aware of these externalities and to try to find them and to try to dig into them, more so than even the courts, because very often a lot of these nuances are things that I discover that the judge doesn't have the time to discover. And, you know, you see these two very, very angry people and you don't know how to diffuse it. And you have to be creative and creative in thinking. And that's why I think one of the most important things that I do, which I don't find a lot of lawyers doing besides myself and some real professionals that I know, is strategic thinking, where you're not just showing up in court once in a while. You're actually strategizing and looking at the whole case and thinking about where is this going to go and where do I want this to go and how is this going to make sense and how am I going to solve it? And that's something that is absolutely, absolutely critical.
You have to know the scope of the other side. When you're involved in litigation, it's like a football game. At a football game, one team sizes up the other team. Who's the runner? Who's the passer? How many games have they won? How many games have they lost? Who's injured? Who's getting off the injury list? Who's going to cover who? That's setting that up your strategy. In litigation, you got to know how much money you got to litigate, how much at risk you have rather than compromising and settling. Is it worth the money you want to spend for the fight? You have to know how much money the other side has to spend on a lawyer. A little, a lot. And then once you get through that analysis, then you have to evaluate your judge. You want to keep the judge that you have been assigned to, or strategically, is it better to switch the judge out, which you usually get one opportunity to do that. But you have to do that fast. And then what that tells you what you're going to do for the next step. And you need to know all of these things so you know for the next 6 months what's going to happen, why it's happening, and what to expect. And then, and only then, because you've gotten through this whole process now of standing up, realizing what's really going on, taking an affirmative step to protect yourself, your life, your children, now you're driving the bus and now you're in charge. And that'll lead us up to our next show, which we're going to go through the science of divorce. The mystery of divorce from beginning to the end.
The mystery.
And in the meantime, please write Adam at AdamLawyer.
Adam at AdamLawyer.com.
I never write you.
Adam at AdamLawyer.com. Call me toll free at 1-800-340-7320. That's 1-800-340-7320. I answer my phone personally. I'm happy to talk to you. No charge, of course. Free consultation. And you can check me out online at www.adamlawyer.com or, of course, on Facebook.
Da, 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 da.
Now, that was an hour and 1 minute. But I'm realizing something else. And I'm realizing something else is there was no commercials.
Yeah.
So it's like without a fucking break. I used to do it with commercials. You know, you like 20 minutes or 15 minutes to take a break. Doing it for an hour straight is a little on the exhausting side.
Really? You found that difficult?
A little
really? I'm like, well, here we are again.
Here we are again.